The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Extra, the Europa League final. Chelsea sarry ball their way to victory over a non-existent Arsenal in a weird, atmosphereless game in Baku that none of us could really see properly. What next for Hazard, Sarri, Emery and Ozil? And when will Olivier Giroud get the credit he deserves? It's the Champions League final this weekend, Liverpool v Spurs. How should both sides approach it? We'll congratulate Villa on promotion to the Premier League, run through some transfer rumours and speculate whether Gianni Infantino will be voted in as head of FIFA when he stands unopposed next month. All that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Hello, Philippe Auclair.
Good morning to you, Max Rushton.
It's nice to see you.
It's very nice to see you too.
I put that FIFA bit in the intro, so that means we have to include your three-hour rant about FIFA in the pod at some point.
It will give a good practice to the editor in the pod.
Paolo Bandini, nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
Are you well?
I'm a little bit disappointed about what happened last night, but Otherwise, yes.
Okay, and you are slightly hungover.
Slightly.
Okay. Not to the point where you sort of get emotional at nothing.
No. Okay. I'd say I'm less so than I was when I woke up this morning.
Now, Barry, I presumed you would be hungover, given you had a Twitter spat with Thomas Bjorn yesterday. But it turns out that was an alcohol-free...
Purely and entirely legitimate Twitter spat.
Well, as I've nailed my colours to the Thomas Bjorn mast.
Duly noted.
Yes.
For everyone who's almost certainly unaware of it, Mike Calvin, friend of the pod, has written yet another book, Mind Game, The Secrets of Golf's Winners. And as with all Calvin's books, it's excellent. He was embedded with the Ryder Cup team last year, the victorious European Ryder Cup team, captained by Thomas Bjorn. And I fear, though, that Mike has been radicalised through overexposure to golfers for an extended period of time.
It's the Stockholm Syndrome.
And I'm torn because it's a really good book, but I also feel that the Ryder Cup is arguably, along with the Lions Tour, the greatest sporting atrocity ever inflicted upon humanity.
You will soon be torn by Bjorn.
I commented to that effect on Twitter, and Thomas Bjorn didn't take kindly to my comments.
I think Thomas was well within his rights, frankly, for you to write off all golfers with a broad stroke. Anyway.
Have you met many golfers?
As I said, I had a nice chat with Andy Sullivan once. I played 18 holes with Shane Lowry, and he was a total delight.
He's an exception to the rule.
And Graham McDowell took me out for dinner once, and it was lovely.
Right.
So, yeah, 3 out of 3. I've never met a nasty one. Those in golf clubs, you know, snotty-nosed amateurs in golf clubs, I'm with you, 100%. But
Has anyone else here, to just totally take on a random tangent, anyone else here play foot golf at all?
No, but
We once interviewed some foot golfers on the radio, didn't we?
I know where this is going. I asked the stupidest question of all time. I asked the foot golf national champion if he had a caddy. Left foot or right foot? What do you reckon?
Imagine
you might go right foot again.
You know, you might have like a putting boot. Like you swap your shoe out for one that's just got a little bit more subtlety. Or, you know, you could have your Predators with a, you know, when you need some curl on the shot.
Yeah, you're right. That's a good point.
Sylvain Wiltord thought of becoming a pro golf footballer when he hung up his boots in the real game. Yes, absolutely.
Really? Producer Jonathan says, please start the podcast. okay, so the Europa League final. Rich says, are you going to sit as far apart from each other as possible in a homage to last night's game? Joe says, will UEFA regret using the cameras at the Wanda Metropolitano to broadcast last night's game? the attendance, this is from James Benge, attendance was 7,000 lower than group stage game between Karabag and Arsenal in the same stadium. I mean, it was a weird game, Paolo. I wonder if we think it was even worse than it was because of all the lead-up into Baku and the problems with Baku, and we didn't want it to be a good game, and then it turned out to not be very good either.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think I probably have a slightly different perspective just on the feel of it because of the reason for the aforementioned hangover. Thanks for everyone bringing it up. But yeah, like the reason for it is I watched it in a pub in North London. And actually, like the atmosphere in that pub and lots of the pubs around there was absolutely sort of... it was on, you know, people were singing songs and making a lot more noise than you get at the average Arsenal home game from six in the evening. I thought that the football clearly was atrocious in the first half and like really like extraordinary stuff going on in the first few minutes. People just passing the ball just straight off the pitch and I... the atmosphere may have played a part in that. It's sort of hard for me to judge. As I say, I couldn't even hear the commentary or the stuff in the ground as much. So you have a better perspective on that than I would. But the
you're a lucky boy.
But the one thing that immediately struck me is there's got to be a bit to do with having had this huge pause between the end of the season and playing a crucial game. I think actually in some ways. Probably all of the English clubs are now lucky that they're playing other English clubs, because I think if you had a team that just finished its season last week, they'd be sharper than this. I think those two look like teams that are already sort of halfway into their summer. And I think that that's a problem which is actually the English game's fault, because Premier League didn't have to end as early as it did. The reason it did that is because you need to make up on the schedule for an FA Cup final and then playoff games at Wembley, and that's why it all gets squeezed forward. But every other European league, I'm not sure about the Bundesliga, but finished later. Big European League. Sorry, of course, there's a lot of leagues in Europe, so some of them are nowhere near the same schedule. The football was really bad, and it seemed like the atmosphere was also really bad. I say the football was bad. The football was really bad in the first half. Chelsea obviously played some lovely stuff once they got going. A couple of the goals were very very nice goals. But yeah, it was a very odd occasion for sure.
I found it extraordinarily flat and. It's funny because I was watching it with some fellow Gooners, but in a home, and we could hear the commentary, and honestly, you didn't miss much. And it was just bad from start to finish. I mean, the pre-game entertainment was atrocious. I think it's the third time we've used the word atrocious in the pod today, probably a record. And I think the fact that Arsenal were marginally the better side for the first 30 minutes tells a lot about how mediocre a game that was, because this is an Arsenal side which has lost its way for, 2 months now, something like that, and which looked exactly how it had looked against Brighton and Crystal Palace in all those games, which honestly, the notion of pleasure has been taken away from football, basically. It's been extracted surgically by Unai Emery and his players. And against just a team that I thought was, you know, fully deserving of its victory. And amazingly, nobody amongst the Arsenal fans that I was with denied that. They all thought, yeah, they were better than we were by a distance.
It's hard for any Arsenal fan to say they weren't better than you by a distance.
Well, you know, you might say, well, the first half was even, that perhaps there should have been a penalty or two penalties and so on. And we could have gone back into the game with Iwobi's goal, but then we were too open at the back, all this sort of rubbish. But nobody actually stuck to that. So basically, we're beaten fair and square by the better side. Which scored, by the way, some absolutely lovely goals.
They did.
Especially Olivier Giroud's goal, which was a thing of wonder.
Yeah. Giroud's header was beautiful. His assist for Hazard was brilliant as well. Alan Algar tweeting, incredible Giroud stat. 16 goals for club and country this season. Every single one of them has been one touch.
That's amazing.
That's amazing.
That's a really amazing
Who's
stat?
That other lad? Bash Dost, you know, the enormous...
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
I think he had some ridiculous record of scoring with one touch, presumably because...
Edinson Cavani as well.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Is that enough for Giroud to become a main centre-forward at Chelsea or anywhere else?
Well, I'm surprised, actually, he has scored that many, because he never actually seems to play. And, you know, he's very much a bit part player at Chelsea. I think he's a terrific player. I'm not sure Sarri fancies him as someone who particularly fits into his system, his famous system. But then Sarri may not be there next season. We don't know yet. I have a feeling he'll probably leave, but he may not. But... Yeah, I would happily have Giroud as a centre forward.
The odd thing, Barry, though, you say he's not really doesn't feature in Sarri's plans, which is absolutely true. But on the other hand, he's been the star player in the competition in which Chelsea have done the best and scored 11 goals. Which
and they're
is
the only
record.
Team to never to be unbeaten in the Europa League.
Yeah,
ever.
Yeah, I mean, just to give the numbers on Giroud, in the Europa League, he's averaged basically a goal every 100 minutes he's played. He's got 11 goals. He only started seven of them, but he played in 27 Premier League games and only scored twice. So he did play in a lot of games in the Premier League. He didn't get to start many of them, but it's a very wide disparity between his scoring rate in two competitions.
But if you have the right players around him, he's you know, like he was for France in the World Cup. Then he Indeed. Didn't have a shot on target in the World Cup, which Correct. I dispute. But still, if
but
you
he was essential.
Yeah, totally essential.
Oh, he was far from a passenger, you know.
Well, they started without him, didn't they, in the first game? Mm. And they realised they needed him there. What about Eden Hazard? Two goals, probably his last game. Where does he stand, Philippe, in the list
in my
of Premier
heart, very, very high.
Yeah,
and the list very of sad to see him go, and Premier I think everybody great. Is. Yeah, absolutely. I would certainly put him in the last decade. He's one, my top five, certainly. But a vastly underrated player. And I'm genuinely happy that he scored twice in a fight.
Do you think he's underrated?
I think he's underrated because I keep hearing the same thing. He's not a big game player. He doesn't show up in the really big occasions, which is utter bollocks. Because, for example, Belgium at the World Cup never gets to the semi-finals without Eden Hazard. Never. Chelsea, when they win the title with Mourinho the second time round, he basically carries the team on his shoulders through very, very difficult games for the whole of the second part of the season. Here, he's also decisive. He's been the best player for Chelsea this season again. One of the reasons why they qualify directly for the Champions League. You carry on and you think, he doesn't score big goals, really? He doesn't score in the big games, really? And so I'm delighted that he scored for him, that he scored in the big finals. So some cretins can shut up.
I mean,
but from that,
I love it when you swear, but I think you saying bollocks is one of my favourite moments of the season. It just sounds so great in your accent. Gavin says, was the badgering of Hazard post-match about next season a bit much?
Yep.
Stopped him celebrating. He clearly didn't want to talk about it. The right of the people to know his plans, right them, seems, he says, bollocks or dubious at best. It was Daryl Curry from BT, who seems quite, I don't know him, but seems quite a decent chap, actually, of all the people that do that quite tricky job, actually. He got a lot of praise from people in the business saying he did a really great job getting that out of Hazard.
Well, it seems to be a thing. It's a TV thing. You have to, rather than just show us the celebrations, you have to grab players and get their immediate post-match reaction and ask them pertinent questions about their future if their future is in some doubt. I personally don't see the need for it. I'm not going to criticise Daryl Curry because I presume, like Des Kelly or whoever else is doing the job, they've been instructed by a producer to do this thing. I find it completely unnecessary. I don't see much harm in it, but, you know, getting I'm probably going to leave Chelsea out of Eden Hazard is not exactly a massive scoop, is it? Because Eden Hazard has always been very open, you know, and is happy to field any questions generally. But, you know, I think pretty much everyone was fairly sure it was going to be his last game, and he kind of confirmed it. So we're not really any much the wiser than we were before the question was asked.
There are moments where you can and should ask questions which are going to upset your interlocutor. And I will take one example is when Rob Harris, who is called Trouble in the business, went to Pep Guardiola after the win in the FA Cup and asked him a question about Roberto Mancini and the payments which have been made by the club. I thought that was totally on because it was something which is in the news, very important news indeed, and which he had refused to talk about. And it was the only chance that you would get of asking him the question directly. I think that was totally legitimate, even if he got a lot of stick for it. In the case of what is happening with the players after a final, I actually stopped doing TV work last year, and that's one of the reasons why I stopped, because I couldn't stand doing it any longer. Because you are, as Barry said, you are instructed by your producers, so you've got to put that question in. You say, no, I don't think it's the right moment. I don't think it's the right moment. You have to do it. And if you don't do it, you're going to lose your job, or you're going to get a right bollocking. Mm. And you have sometimes the feeling that you're intruding into a celebration when, honestly, the same thing for Giroud. You know, why do players, what are you feeling right now? Well, you know, let him feel it. Give him space. Let him enjoy. We can see he's very moved. We know why he didn't celebrate whilst celebrating. We all know that. And is that, has it got to be said? Have you got to put the guy in a real spot? And then he says, oh, now I'm a true blue, and people will have a go at him. Well, he didn't mean to say that, but you force him to do that. And for Eden, who's just scored twice for the first time in the European final, it's not the presenter's fault, but I think it's totally out of order.
Christian says, how are Chelsea fans supposed to react to this second half Sarri tactical masterclass? How do you combine joy and fury in one facial expression?
It is an interesting one. I mean, Chelsea fans, quite a number of them have made no secret of or utter contempt for Sarri and his tactics during the season. He's got them to two finals, 1-1, and qualified them for the Champions League by finishing third. I would say that's, to use a golfing analogy, which I'm sure Thomas Bjorn would appreciate, definitely par, and I'd say, you know, a subpar round.
Again, I know it's not news to anyone anymore that he used to be working in a bank that he did come from, but he has had now this extraordinary career, and this is his crowning moment. Like, I mean, maybe there's more to come, but he has not won a trophy until now. This is such a brilliant story. A guy who's come into football management late in, you know, much later in life than most people do, and without any background as a professional player, and he's just won a European Cup, guys. I mean, I think it's amazing. I think it's cool.
Well,
he was named Chelsea manager on the 14th of July. Their first game was on the 5th of August. 16 of his players had been to the World Cup, including very late in the competition. He had no preseason. Mm-hmm. Eden Hazard actually didn't start the games, the first two games of the season. And you carry on, and you think, are you crazy, guys? I mean,
do you think he's going to be there? Do you think he's going to stay?
It appears that it's not going to be the case, even though it's in Tutor Sports, so you shouldn't you shouldn't have confidence in anything Tutor Sports says when they publish this picture of Bruce Buck in a deep conversation with Andrea Agnelli, which means that there is some kind of agreement going on, perhaps between Chelsea and Juve, for Maurizio Sarri, that is. But he has honestly done everything that was expected of him, and the way people turned against him because of this 5 weeks, starting with the loss against Arsenal, then the loss at Bournemouth, the loss against Man City. But the League Cup, and also he was ridiculed because of the League Cup, what happened with Kepa. But on the other hand, Chelsea had been better than City on that day. Mm. Chelsea inflicted their first defeat on Manchester City at Stamford Bridge in the season. I mean, you look at it from a distance, you think, this is crazy.
I really wanted him to take Kepa off in the last minute. I wanted to salute Gary Cahill in the John Terry role in full kit, but producer Jonathan points out Rob Green. Two goalkeepers on the bench, neither one of them him, still in full kit to lift the trophy. Monty says, Max, is Barry happy that Arsenal did end up boycotting the match after all?
I was actually going to say that I wrote an article last week saying Arsenal should boycott the tournament, and Mesut Ozil at least wholeheartedly embraced my advice. They were diabolically bad, I think, and I suppose it's no huge surprise that they lost, but the manner of their capitulation was just so Arsenal-y that if I was a gooner, I would be very depressed this morning, not just because lost the final, but they just don't seem to be particularly going anywhere. They need new players, clearly, and now they're going to have trouble attracting them because A, they have bugger all money to spend, just figures at the moment putting around 50 million, and obviously anything they bring in from selling players, and they can't promise new arrivals Champions League football, so grim times.
Sam says, Ozil sulking off the pitch when being subbed has got to be the lowest of the lows for him. I'm really hoping Newcastle make him their statement signing. but as a sort of fan, I love Mesut Ozil. I mean, I love what a footballer he is, and he's just scored some beautiful goals. But I think even the apologists for Ozil are starting to think this has got to change, right?
Yeah. Well, you needed him to turn up last night, and he just didn't. His contribution was negligible, and then, he's just sulking on the bench after he got taken off and replaced by a 19-year-old I must confess I had never, ever heard of before.
Joe Willock. Who actually had a decent game.
Yeah, missed the chance, but did look. Gave him energy, didn't he?
As did Alexi Iwobi.
Yeah, Iwobi was the best Arsenal player, I think, by a...
with Petr Cech.
Yeah. Yeah, there's lots to worry about for Arsenal. Obviously, Lacazette has sort of suggested that he might not be hanging around next season, or at least that his future is uncertain. And I think if he went... It's really oversimplifying, but at the same time, hard not to chart the end of this season against Aaron Ramsey getting injured. And guess what? Aaron Ramsey ain't there next season. So, yeah, it is worrying, because there was a period, I think, where people really felt like actually things were changing under Emery. And now you sort of take a step back from it and you think, has much changed for the better at all in any concrete sense?
Colin says, Arsenal, the only club to lose the final of all three major European competitions. They've also lost in the European
Super Cup. They had to get there to start with.
That is a good point, Philippe. Omar Chowdhury, Arsenal's defeat means Sparta Prague. It's an interesting consequence of this defeat. Sparta Prague need to go through two Europa League qualifying rounds next season rather than entering at the group stage. A particularly bad night for their sporting director, Thomas Rosicky.
No way!
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. On the other hand, very good news for Lyon. Lyon goes straight into the group phase of the Champions League.
Can someone explain how that is a thing?
No, we have very little time.
Okay.
It's all coefficients and rankings and so on and so forth, and permutations and so on.
Keaton says, only one Englishman started in the All-English Europa League final. Is that a good or a bad thing in the larger scheme? I mean, in the greater scheme of things, Keaton, I'd say, you know, none of this matters at all, but...
I've read that, and but I think there would have been also circumstances...
Loftus-Cheek would have
Loftus-Cheek and Hudson-Odoi.
Yeah, I'm probably right. So Arsenal into the Europa League... and Chelsea win a trophy. Just felt like a pre-season friendly, Barry.
You know, it was a weird game because watching it, you know, you got that loads of empty seats, that big green, well, what is a running track covered with green cloth or whatever around the weird camera angle. All you needed really was the commentary to be coming down a dodgy phone line. And it was like watching, say, the Republic of Ireland against Czechoslovakia in 1979 on TV at home. It was just a weird game, and I have every sympathy for Arsenal Chelsea fans who went and had this ordeal to get there. I was actually talking to Reshmin Chowdhury at the Arsenal Open Day last week, the BT Sport pitchside commentator and friend of the show, and she was moaning about, you know, telling me her itinerary for getting to Baku, and while it did smack a bit of, and I said this to her, you know, my wallet's too small for my 50s and my diamond shoes are too tight, it was just sounded like a massive ball ache just to get there, and obviously for fans it's worse because they're paying for it out of their own pockets, and then you have fans who wanted to go and couldn't. And it was just farcical, but UEFA's utter contempt for supporters has been laid bare as if we didn't know about it already. And Arsenal's both clubs have also been criticised, I think, for not attempting to make life easier for their fans, put in a word with UEFA or subsidise travel costs or whatever, but... Again, fans don't seem that, or clubs don't seem that fussed about looking after their own either.
Genuinely, if I ran football, I would say everyone who's qualified for the Europa League, I'd put them all on a hat and I'd draw out two semi-finals and say, you start in May, semi-finals, 1st of May. Because I don't think that would be better.
I pay absolutely no attention to the Europa League until sort of semi-final stage, because it's on Thursday night, and by the time it gets around to Thursday, you've been watching football Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, possibly the preceding Friday as well. I just need a break, and
I'm completely with you.
Yeah.
I think we're seeing that from a very Anglo-centric perspective. In other countries, the Europa League is a very big competition. I saw the impact it had in some clubs, like Rennes in France, for example, when they won at Betis. That was an absolutely extraordinary performance. When I saw the impact that Eintracht Frankfurt, for example.
Say Fulham or Middlesbrough, you know.
Absolutely, I do remember. I mean, that Fulham campaign was one of, I mean, which I followed from start to finish, was one of the most pleasant, agreeable things that I've ever done. And I'm not a Fulham fan, but I really absolutely loved every second of it. So I think we're a little bit, we can be poo-pooing it a little bit. In a way, it's devalued by the fact we have Chelsea and Arsenal not good enough to compete for the title in England, competing in this final.
And looking not good enough.
Yeah. The other thing I would say, before shutting up, is when we come to these venues, I really do not understand why venues are chosen in advance. I do not, well in advance. In other, you know, to take the MLB, for example, in America, we seem to take all the bad habits of the Americans, none of the good ones. Now, the World Series can take place anywhere. You know, you don't say, oh, it's going to take place in Houston or Chicago or Boston. No, there's no reason in the 21st century when you couldn't decide 4 weeks in advance where you're going to have the final. There's absolutely no reason why not.
Isn't the World Series home and away?
Yeah, but you don't know who's going to qualify,
No.
But you know, people say, well, you know, it's so complicated to organise and this and this that. No, it's not. It is possible. Mm. You're talking about moving 30,000 people, something like that. And no, it's not undoable, but it has to be done in advance for reasons which I'll leave you to guess. And again, the fans can bugger off.
I just wanted to add on the previous thing about the Europa League. Like, there's one really easy thing that is not trashing it that I just don't understand why they don't do, which is just getting rid of the Champions League teams dropping into it. You take a round out of the competition.
Yeah.
It's that extra last 32 rounds. And it is, I completely agree with Philippe that I think we can sort of get too much, like, with the Premier League and Champions League focus on it, think that it's not relevant when it is to lots of teams. And I think actually even Arsenal, a lot of fans really enjoyed that competition this season. But it's such a drain to play through everything. And it's super fascinating, for instance, a team like Atalanta in Italy, who actually had a really good Europa League run a couple of years ago and were really committed to doing well in it again this year, but lost their last qualifier against Copenhagen on penalties and were at the time quite shattered about it. And then they went on to finish third, and subsequently Gasperini said it's probably the best thing that happened to us all season was not having to deal with it. So yeah, it is it's too big at the moment, and you can argue about whether or not you need it at all or the things you've said, but I just think that the extra round created by Champions League teams who weren't good enough to win the Champions League is so unnecessary.
And Unai Emery said in the build-up to this final that at the start of the season his players couldn't be bothered with the Europa League. They weren't in the slightest bit interested, and it's good to see that continued right through till the end of the season as well.
Producer Jonathan makes a good point that, you know, the Champions League knockout fixtures are announced like a couple of weeks before, and they managed to organise that. In fact, all cup competitions, I guess you have to arrange a game. Ben Priggett says, I decided to turn the game off and watch Chernobyl instead, which is probably where UEFA will decide to hold next year. And that'll do for part one. We'll start part two with the Championship playoff final. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Before we look ahead to the Champions League final, let's congratulate Aston Villa, beat Derby 2-1 in the Championship playoff final on Monday. After two last-minute winners in the playoffs, this was sort of less gripping, but they deserved it, didn't they, Baz?
I think so. I don't think Derby gave a very good account of themselves at all, created very little going forward, and if they had a plan, I couldn't figure out what it was. But they did pull one back when all looked lost, and for the last 10 minutes did threaten and possibly could have got an equaliser, but I'd say they have very few complaints and the better team won on the day, definitely. Adrian Durham, our TalkSport colleague, who I very rarely agree with, made an interesting point in the after the game, and it's something that occurred to me at the time. I didn't say anything, but I'm not saying this with the benefit of 2020 hindsight, but he thought that perhaps Derby played their final in the second leg against Leeds and over-celebrated that. Mm. We saw how mad they went after that game. And I think he might have a point. I'm not saying that's why they lost against Villa. I just think that maybe was their final and they got a bit carried away with the celebrations. I can understand why the players might do that, but the manager shouldn't. And I think Frank Lampard might think he maybe dropped a bit of a bollock there because he was sort of front and centre of all those celebrations.
I mean, I guess he's quite a new manager, and the normal reaction for Frank Lampard would be to celebrate like a player, right?
Absolutely, and it's a very mild criticism, but he is a young manager. He's an inexperienced manager, but you know, I wouldn't imagine many other managers would get as carried away as he did after winning just the semi-final.
How well has Dean Smith done, Paolo?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know who this Dean Smith character is. I thought John Terry was in charge of the site, but it seems like they've done well. No, it's a tough thing to as a club to come back from what they had last year, losing the final when you thought you thought it was your year and your destiny. So he's done fantastically, and then the way they ended the season was really, really impressive.
They were not in a great state, were they, when you arrived at the club? And remember, at the time they were thinking of appointing Thierry Henry, who did so well at Monaco.
Yeah.
And proving himself. It's not that young thing. He's 48. Mm-hmm. In Smith. But I mean, what he had done at Brentford made people realize, you know, there's got a pretty serious manager here, and very well done to him, I must say. I've got a question for you, though. A question I was asking myself on my way to the pod. I was wondering, of the three promoted sides, who is going to be the Wolves and who are going to be the Cardiffs?
I mean, your first instinct is that Sheffield United will struggle.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure. I'm basing that purely on finances. I think for them to survive would be truly miraculous, wouldn't it?
I don't know a huge amount about Sheffield United's finances or how to fix. I do think the three sides that have gone up have got three excellent managers.
That is true. Yeah, Wilder's a brilliant manager.
Wilder is brilliant. Dean Smith's brilliant. And Daniel Farke is brilliant. I would imagine at least one of them will probably go back down, but if I know who.
I mean, the question for Villa, though, is Jack Grealish is an absolute key man for them. Tammy mm-hmm. Abraham as well. Tyrone mm-hmm. Mings. None of these guys might be there at the start of next season, right?
Well, there probably would be a lesser chance of them being there at the start of next season if they hadn't won.
That is true.
the playoffs. I think it would very much depend on how much money the Aston Villa board is prepared to put into that. And I'm not absolutely sure that there's an awful lot of money to spend, as far as they're concerned.
But the thing about Grealish is, for a starter, I would imagine he would be very open to captaining his, you know, it's his club. Yeah. Dean Smith's a Villa fan. He's a Villa fan. I'd imagine he'd be open to the possibility of captaining his hometown club that he loves and supports and that all his family support for a season in the Premier League. And if he decides he wants to leave, there'll be no shortage of offers, and he'd generate a huge fee, which would presumably then be reinvested.
We'll do a few.
And
more.
He could buy some new boots,
some full size gym pads.
Did you see his tatty boots?
No, but no. I have gone Grealish. I now wear kids' shin pads.
Okay.
It just makes it easy. You know, the big ones can affect your ball control a little bit.
But they did a close-up on his boots in his post-match interview, and I would imagine the good people at Nike were absolutely appalled because they look like he's been wearing them since he was about 6 years old. You know, Billy's boots in Roy the Rovers.
Is it Kyle Walker who's never, ever changed his shin pads? He still plays with the same shin pads now than he started.
They must reek. Shin pads, after a while, like, they absorb your sweat.
You've got to put them
time.
In the washing machine occasionally, the shin pads. Just chuck it all in. Well, I played football with a guy who worked for Nike who said it's this interesting part of football that you never really think exists. Obviously, all these massive sponsorship deals. There are all these people just checking that each player is wearing the right boots. And then sometimes, you know, Super Sunday and someone is just wearing it. The wrong pair of Nikes, not a pair of Nikes. And there's all sorts of, you know, there's phone calls going left, right and centre because they're in they're in last year's boots. Because if you're a player,
It's incredible because,
and the players.
I never noticed. The only reason I noticed Grealish's were Nikes is because they were in such a state of disrepair that the interviewer sort of got the cameraman to do a close up to show how tatty they were. Otherwise, I would have no idea who wears what.
Isn't it the guys who supply the equipment to actually tell the players which boots they should wear? And that's one of the reasons why Nicholas Bentner, Lord Bentner, wore the famous pink shoes.
Is
apparently
that right?
It was an instruction from his manufacturer.
Well, I know that John Fashanu, when he was playing for Wimbledon, used to, on a televised game, would kick his boot off so the camera would focus in on him putting his boot back on, so they'd get a big close-up, and they would... The, I think the boot manufacturers then just sort him out a little bit.
That's amazing.
Isn't it amazing?
Although that makes me think, see, I would think, God, that boot keeps coming off. Must be a bad boot.
Oh, really?
It's obviously loose. It's not well designed.
It's a bit like the skiers, you know, when they finish the downhill. The first thing they do is to put the skis with the brand in full view of the cameras.
I've never thought about that.
And see also cyclists zipping up their shirts when they're approaching the finish line on a hot day.
When Andy Murray won the US Open, I was so excited. And then he spent 10 minutes asking everybody where his watch was, because clearly that was worth more than lifting the trophy. That upset me a little bit. Anyway, from yesterday, 2 days after the match, the Villa Zone tweeting Jack Grealish, "You still partying?" Jack replies, "Does a bear shit in the woods?" So he's still having a nice time. Right, Saturday, 8 o'clock, Liverpool versus Spurs. Naby Keita's out for Liverpool. Firmino probably fit. Harry Kane for Spurs says, "I'm ready to go." The manager will assess it, decide whether I'm ready to go or not, but so far I feel good and ready. Liverpool won both games in the league 2-1. Early in the season at Wembley, they completely outplayed Spurs. Spurs probably the better side in the second game, certainly in the second half. Mm-hmm. Sissoko had that chance. Mm-hmm. How do both sides approach this game, Philippe?
With hope and optimism. I don't know. I think that approaching it from a Spurs perspective must be very easy indeed, because nobody's expecting anything from them. So in their usual situation, which they were in at the Camp Nou, which they were in against Manchester City, against Ajax, which is why I put my money on Tottenham.
Would you?
Yep.
They're under no pressure whatsoever. All the pressure is on Liverpool. Liverpool lost last year. Sort of Jurgen Klopp has this reputation for being unable to win finals. Liverpool have a huge amount of expectation. They came so close in the league and failed. Maybe a bit harsh, but yes.
They are better than Spurs, though.
Yeah.
Yes.
I agree with exactly what these guys are saying. I think that there's no question in this tie that the pressure is on one team much more than on the other. But the flip of that, as you just said, Max, it's on them because they're better. I mean, it's the one thing you get when you get teams playing in a European final and play in the same league, is you have that opportunity for a direct comparison. And Liverpool, what, 26 points better than Tottenham this year? Yeah, they have been a better team in this season. That doesn't mean that Tottenham can't beat them, can't be better than them over 90 minutes. But Liverpool have been the better team over the course of the last 9 months.
And while we say they're under pressure and all the pressure is on them, they have shown they're perfectly capable of handling pressure, so that, you know, it may not be a huge factor. But if they lose, I think the consequences for them would be far more disastrous than they would be for Spurs.
I mean, people saying the consequences are worse for Spurs if they win, because Pochettino might leave. And that goes back to Paolo going, you should probably enjoy the cup final for a cup final and worry what happens afterwards the next day. For Liverpool, pretty much the team picks itself, apart from who you pick in midfield.
I was interested to hear what you were saying about Firmino. And I think one of the questions for both managers is going to be, what do we do with half-fit players? So do I start Kane? Do I start Firmino if they're not match fit?
Harry Winks as well.
Yep.
Who hasn't played for
Winks,
a long time.
But Winks is I don't know, you really feel when, I'm sorry, it sounds crazy to say that, you really feel it when Winks is not there. He's really the type of player for, it's simple, Pochettino has got a plan B. When Kane is not around, the team plays slightly differently. Lucas Moura, Son, Eriksen, they permutate far more than they do. When Winks is not there, there isn't really nobody who has this role. It's extraordinary to say that about a player who was complete unknown 2 seasons ago. But I would say this is a huge call for me between the two strikers. And we have also the same thing. We don't know in which state these players are going to be. Yeah. Again, this is this thing that, how long has it been since they last played?
Three weeks.
How easy?
That's a long time.
But how easy is it to actually work out? I mean, obviously you can do all sorts of fitness tests, right? You can. Is it? And I don't,
very high intensity training.
Yeah, I mean, none of us are experts, I guess. But how you can't replicate that unless you play a football match. And we were speculating that both sides would have been playing behind closed doors games against somebody somehow.
Yeah. Well, Arsenal did it, and it
didn't work.
Didn't work, did it? But they had played behind closed doors against an Austrian team, but didn't work for them.
It's kind of like practicing for a penalty shootout. You know, you can practice and practice and practice, but you can't replicate the actual conditions of the situation you're going to be in a final.
When you say the Liverpool team picks itself in the absence of Keita...
Well, that's the only question in midfield. I mean, because Wijnaldum made such a difference in that second half. You think he plays... There's this whole idea of Milner and Henderson, and they play in the Nou Camp and it didn't work. Mm-hmm. That sort of three slightly older...
Fabinho.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, you know, the back four is the back four.
Mm-hmm.
And the front three are the front three. For Spurs, it's tricky, isn't it? Because it's a risk with Winks. But otherwise, you drop Ali back deeper or Eriksen back deeper alongside Sissoko in that three.
Well, it all depends whether you start with Kane or you don't.
Mm. And the argument I think someone was having on Monday was it's safer to start Kane when he comes off than to not start Kane and then you bring him on and then he comes off.
I see that.
Do you see what I mean? If you bring him on after 60and then you have to bring Llorente on for him.
Yeah. Worth noting the last time he was out injured, beginning of this year, he missed. How many games did he miss?
Well, there was this time in which he missed
8 games from January into February. He came back, and off the back of that, he scored in 6 of his next 7 games. So he has some form for coming back from injury and being able to hit the ground.
Although Spurs went on that terrible run, didn't they? He came back against Burnley, and Spurs went on that terrible run.
And when he was out of the team, they won 4 on the trot in the league, and they won 3-0 against Borussia Dortmund.
Yeah, this is a fascinating conundrum about this Tottenham team for sure. They have a fantastic. World-class number 9 who scores goals by the hatful, and yet some of their best performances have been when he hasn't been there. And the second leg against Manchester City, I still wonder if they get through that with him in the team, because it was the pace of Son, the way he stretched the pitch, that was so critical in that first bit.
And Lucas Moura scored a hat-trick in the second half of the second leg of the semi-final.
Yeah. So,
I wrote a piece in the paper, my sort of annual piece, which we discussed on the pod about me not going to the game and watching it with my dad. And lots of people wrote lots of nice comments, very strange below the line to be quite a friendly place. But I got this amazing tweet from someone called Ralph Turner saying, "My dad is the reason I'm a Spurs fan, the reason I love football. However, I won't be able to watch with him as he recently discovered Buddhism and is on a 4-month retreat with no contact to the outside world. He doesn't even know we beat City. It all feels weird." So I replied going, "Is this serious?" And he went, "Genuinely, there is an emergency phone for things like deaths in the family, but only my stepmom has the number, and apparently this isn't that level. We are yet to discuss what happens if we actually win the thing. He left just before the City first leg. He gets back in late July. We're discussing how we break the news to him. Maybe a YouTube highlights compilation."
That is fantastic.
So, I mean, he's come back from, 4-month Buddhist retreat. If they show him those games, how zen will he be when Lucas Moura goes through in the 96th minute? Well, the Raheem Sterling VAR moment. I mean, this is a huge test of his Buddhism,
isn't
it?
Newfound serenity.
Just amazing. Valma. Just absolutely film that.
That is brilliant,
isn't it?
Story.
But the thing is, they can't, if they say, "We've got all the matches and you've got to watch them back to back," presumably he'll smell a rat there, because he'd be like, "Why, someone just tell me, how did Spurs get on?" It must be one of his first questions, you imagine. So they've got to find a subtle way of showing him that Man City second leg, of showing him the Ajax second leg. Absolutely brilliant story, isn't it?
Wasn't there this football fan who woke up from a very deep coma, which had lasted years?
I think so,
And his first question was, "Did we win?"
Sort of the same. We will, of course, review the Champions League final on Monday's pod. Come on, Spurs. And that'll do for part two. In part three, it will be Any Other Business and Philippe Auclair's Every Time He's On FIFA Rant. Hello, welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. We've got a rival pod, brotherly, sisterly pod.
A
sibling pod, like a younger, sweet. We shouldn't be jealous of the young brother or sister, should we? We should be loving them.
Yes, indeed. The pod is called The Spin.
Mm-hmm.
A new cricket podcast from The Guardian, which will be recorded and downloaded, I think, twice a week, presented by Emma John, who many cricket aficionados will know from her time at The Observer. She's written several books about cricket, very knowledgeable about sport. And she will be having an array of experts, assorted cricket-loving comedians on. And I have been booked in for an episode.
What?
Yes.
What to do?
I will be providing searing analysis.
But
in
you don't know the first thing about cricket.
Yes, I do.
Well, I know more than you.
Probably.
Yeah. So why have I not been booked?
Well, you probably get booked if you made yourself available.
I'm available for selection.
Right, well, I shall let Emma know. But I will be on, but I'm not on till July and the eve of the test at Lord's between England and Ireland, which I will be attending.
Oh, I see.
A friend and I have booked tickets for the first day because we're slightly worried if we left it any later, it might be over.
First episode.
But anyway, spin, it's already available in all the usual places. And I would heartily recommend it.
First episode last Friday. Andy Ball was on. Comedian James Sherwood, Surrey Stars and England all-rounder Bryony Smith. Tuesday's episode had former Somerset and England cricketer Vic Marks, Jeff Lemon, Sonali Shah as well. The theme tune is written and performed by the horn section, Alex Horn of Taskmaster, who's going to be appearing on the pod at some point. I would like to be on the one that Alex Horn is on, and I will just ask him about Taskmaster. I don't know if the bosses are listening to this. That's the one. Philippe, do you want to go on it? You're a cricket
absolutely, man. I'm a cricket nut, absolutely.
It's running through the World Cup, through to the Ashes as well.
Well, the World Cup goes on for about 4 years, doesn't it?
No, because not as many teams in it now. They've got out all the rubbish ones.
Like Ireland and Scotland
and
Holland.
You're not allowed in it, anyway, back to football. The Newcastle United takeover. You excited about this, Philippe?
Excited. I don't know if I'm excited is the word. I'm very curious and I'm very interested by what is going on exactly. Starting with the identity of this prospective buyer,
Sheikh Khaled.
Sheikh Khaled Al Zayed. The important thing is the Al Zayed at the end, which means that he's a member of that royal family.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the question is he related or not to Sheikh Mansour? Because if he is, there's a big problem there. If you've got two members of the same family who have competing clubs in the same competition, that would be a bit of a problem, wouldn't it?
Depends if they like each other or not. It depends if they're like
and
the Gallagher brothers.
And that is the other thing that I'm very interested in, because, as you know, not everything has always been smooth in the Al Zayed family.
Well, Nick Harris tweeting, the Middle East family tree experts point to Khalid's grandfather murdering Sheikh Mansour's grandfather, his half-brother, in 1926, which is quite
feuds
the Bible.
Feuds have started over less.
Presumably the feud started before that.
I mean, obviously Newcastle fans are very, very excited. I saw George Corkin from the Times, is their Newcastle correspondent. He was sort of live tweeting his very arduous trip to Azerbaijan on one leg, because he's currently on crutches after sustaining an injury playing football. And he had the added anguish of having to deal with this potential Newcastle takeover. I get the vibe from him that, you know, Newcastle fans are basically, George, please tell us it's going to be okay. Please tell us this is going to happen. And he couldn't do that. I'd be sceptical for no other reason than when Sheikh Mansour bought City, we didn't hear about it till it was a done deal. Mm. Ditto when Abramovich bought Chelsea, we didn't hear a word till it was a done deal.
Story from Spain. A number of La Liga and second division players and club executives have been arrested as part of an investigation into match fixing. Police say 11 people are expected to be arrested in total. At least three matches are being investigated across the country's top three divisions. La Liga said it reported its suspicions over a Division 2 match in May last year between Huesca, recently relegated from the top division, and Gimnastique de Tarragona. Spanish media reported that those arrested included the former Real Madrid and Spain player Raúl Bravo, Agustín Lasaúsa, the Huesca president, and several other people connected with the club. Huesca's lawyers say, we're not worried at the club and have said we'll cooperate with whatever the investigation needs from us. Other reports from Spain, El Mundo Deportivo saying Barcelona never considered Roberto Martinez's appointment, insist it's all media noise that came from his camp. You can't imagine Martinez getting the Barcelona job. Can you or can you?
Very little would surprise me in football anymore, but I saw someone saying yesterday that he does have a habit of failing upwards. That would be quite the upward fail, you know. He got tremendous plaudits for getting Belgium to the semi-final of the World Cup, but I still think, or third place, didn't they? They won in the end, but I still think that was kind of like England getting to the semi-final. I still feel they possibly should have done better.
Sergio Ramos has asked to leave Real Madrid, according to Florentino Perez. He's contracted until 2021, but apparently wants to take his career to Kent and Gillingham, or the Chinese Super League, unfortunately. Perez said he was told by Ramos and his agent they'd received a very good offer from an unnamed club, but they could not pay a fee. Perez said, I told Ramos it was impossible for Real Madrid to let their captain go for free. They came to see me at the office. They told me they had a very good offer from China, but the rules there do not allow them to pay a transfer, which seems a very strange rule.
Well, apparently Ramos has fallen out with Perez because Perez keeps blaming him for their Champions League exit. Because if you remember, after the first leg of their round of 16 game against Ajax, at the end of that game, he picked up a yellow card and then bragged about how he'd done it deliberately. To wipe his slate clean and serve a suspension for the second leg, and that didn't work out too well for him on a number of levels. He actually got an increased ban, but apparently Perez has publicly named and shamed him for being responsible for Real's exit.
Some Italy news. Gattuso's left Milan, and Inter have sacked Spalletti. What a Milanese managerial merry-go-round we're due for.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of change at the top clubs in Italy, because Claudio Ranieri is not going to be back at Roma either. There was some speculation that Gasperini might get poached away from Atalanta, but that now looks like it's not going to happen. Yes, Spalletti out, Antonio Conte in. Actually, a really sad story there, because Luciano Spalletti's brother passed away this week, and I think probably becomes an incredibly difficult thing for the club to handle in a sensitive way, because the decision to fire him had been made obviously before that and shouldn't be influenced by someone's personal tragedy, but at the same time, being respectful of that and not behaving awfully about it is a tricky thing for the club. But yeah, big change all around. And Antonio Conte coming in at Inter, and by what's been reported in Italy, first order of business telling Mauro Icardi that he's not going to be part of the plan. So that's a very big piece that we're moving on the transfer market this summer, probably.
And the latest at Juve?
Well, we're waiting to hear. I mean, there's basically been this insinuation that, yes, we'll be able to tell you more once we've been able to speak to some candidates who still have football ongoing. And there are two very prominent Premier League candidates who've been talked about a lot, which is Maurizio Sarri and
Pochettino.
And Sarri will find out. I mean, Sarri basically has been saying, like a lot of people who are involved in these things, rightly, look, I'll talk about this stuff after the final's done. I find it fascinating, actually, with Sarri specifically, because Max Allegri, on his way out at his farewell press conference, which was generally very well handled, he had one line that to me at the time felt like a dig at Sarri, which is he said, in life, some people win and some people lose, and you see it, the people who win all the time, and people who lose all the time. And it felt to me like a look, you know, you guys can kick me out and that's fine, but like all I've done is win, and fair enough. You know, I think Allegri's a fantastic manager, but it felt to me a bit like, but if you replace me with the guy who never wins anything, well, you know, Sarri has won something now. And of course, it's a nonsense line. The idea that some people always win and some people never win is basically only true until that changes. It's like Ranieri sort of being derided by Mourinho as you know, football's great, nearly man, and then he goes and wins the league with Leicester. Like, it's always true that these stories can change and they aren't immutable. But the knock on Sarri certainly was, do we really want to be going after the Champions League with a guy who actually hasn't won a major trophy ever? Well, now he has. So I suppose maybe is a thing that could influence them, or maybe not. We'll find out.
In Germany, Union Berlin promoted to the Bundesliga after beating Stuttgart on away goals over two legs in the promotion relegation playoff. They become the first Bundesliga team from the former East Berlin. Huge celebrations, pitch invasion, buckets of fireworks. They're a big hipster club in Germany. At the other end of the German second division, Ingolstadt, Ralf Hasenhüttl's old team, relegated to the third division in the three seasons since Hasenhüttl left. Relegated in 16-17, from the Bundesliga. 17-18, ninth in the second division. 18-19, relegated to the third division. So in 2023, when we're doing this pod, Southampton will be in League One or League Two. Philippe.
Oui, mon chéri.
Gianni Infantino going for the top job again at the FIFA Paris conference on June the 5th. Good for him. Good for Gianni. You reckon he'll get in?
Well, I tell you what, I'd put my money on him.
Yeah?
I'd put my money on him. Yeah, it will be this grand occasion as per usual. There will be no other candidate. It will be elected unopposed as for another mandate at the head of FIFA.
Is that because to get a mandate you need five nominations
it's because,
or something?
Yeah, you do need a ridiculous number of nominations by FAs. You need to prove that you've done this, that you've done that within football. It's a bit like Florentino Perez laying down the rules for being the president of Real Madrid. You've got to be Florentino Perez, basically. So to be president of FIFA, you've got to be president of FIFA.
This rule introduced when after Grant Wall
that's correct yes when Grant Wall was about I think he had one nomination from the Chilean FA or was about to get it, and they really got scared because they thought if we've got an outsider like this could really become a real problem. So it moved to 5, then it moved to 10 nominations, and basically the regulations have been made more strict almost year after year to make it almost impossible for an outsider basically to be a candidate. And now what happens usually with FIFA as well as for the confederations, very rarely do you have proper fights like you had between Ayatou and Ahmad at the African Confederation in 2017, but very often everything is done beforehand. It's like what happened for the Asian Confederation. You thought that Sheikh Salman would have, you know, 2-3 people against him, and then they drop one after the other, because the one thing you don't want to happen is to lose face. And the last time, Infantino had opponents. He had Prince Ali, he had Jerome Champagne, because it was the post-Blatter Congress. So people felt a little bit freer. And this time, well, the house is now completely controlled by Gianni the First. So it's going to be complete nonsense. I'm going to Paris on the 5th of June just to smell the air and then to have a good breather outside of the Palais des Sports, because it's going to be the usual nonsense.
Is there any way we'll
hear that, of course, the World Cup is not 48 teams in 2022 and all this sort of thing.
But would you get a chance to question Infantino? Does anyone ever get a chance to actually ask him?
They've introduced the mixed zone,
okay,
for Infantino, a member of the FIFA Council, which means basically they never get the hard questions because they've got a gaggle of reporters with fighting with cameramen and people with phones. And he can answer a question in Spanish, in Italian, in French, in English. It's finished. The days when you could actually put him on the spot and ask him very delicate questions. There are plenty of delicate questions to be asked to Mr. Infantino. These days are gone, basically. It's completely controlled. The media are treated with utter scorn, being asked to go through Paris to get accreditation to go back. And it's complete nonsense.
Ask him one question, what would you ask him?
Beep, 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 Mr. Infantino. If I could ask him one question, I don't think I could answer this question on air, to be honest.
Okay.
Barry, presumably your question would be, if you had to fight, would you rather fight one duck-sized Sepp Blatter or 100 Sepp Blatter-sized ducks? Or a yoghurt pot for hats question?
Yeah, obviously.
That's the route I'd go.
What's your favourite colour?
Do you like things?
To answer your question more faithfully, I think the question would be, Mr. Infantino, how you justify emptying FIFA of every single mechanism of transparency. How do you explain that you've got rid of absolutely everything which could lead to better governance within FIFA, being within the ethics committee, governance committee, compliance committee? The fact that you decided there was no need for an anti-racism task force, for example, because the problem had been solved. There are plenty of questions to be asked for Gianni Infantino. But anyway, that's going to be the wonderful way I'm going to spend my week.
And if you don't mind me asking, why are you going?
You've got to be there, and also sometimes you get a chance to go to the right hotels, and you go to the hotel lobbies and the bars. This is where the real conversations happen, and you can get some decent material. And there are rumors that a few interesting things could be happening at the time of the Congress, not to do with Gianni Infantino, but with other personalities at the heart of FIFA. By the way, another one was just banned. The former Secretary General of the Oceania Confederation was banned for 7 years.
I liked Philippe's first explanation better, which when he said he was going to smell the air, because I actually remember going to Paris for the first time as a school kid, and there were selling tins of Paris air that you could buy. I didn't buy one, though. If I'd known it was that good for smelling, I might have done it.
Producer Jonathan says one duck-sized set bladder or 100 set bladder-sized ducks. It's an easy winner, isn't it? 100 ducks of that size. It's frankly terrifying, as opposed to one tiny set, one mini bladder. I hadn't really considered it.
You've heard, by the way, that Sepp Blatter is about to sue Gianni Infantino.
What for?
He's put a plant the Swiss, basically accusing Infantino of engineering his demise and being a very nasty piece of work.
Well, at least one of them.
I think he's absolutely right, by the way.
One of them will lose, right? So that's good. Yeah. England, Gareth Southgate has cut down his squad to 23 from 27. Kieran Trippier, Harry Winks, Nathan Redmond, James Ward-Prowse left out of the Nations League. Dropping Kieran Trippier was... he says, as hard a decision as we have had to make. West Ham news, Andy Carroll, Adrian and Samir Nasri are all going to leave when their contracts expire next month. Where are they going to go? Because I'd say they'd all go to West Ham. But
yeah. Andy Carroll's an interesting one. I mean, he's a good player, but you just cannot keep him fit. So who's going to offer him...
It's got to be pay-as-you-play, right?
Yeah, pay-as-you-play, yeah.
Pay-as-you-play, and he could do a job for...
But
quite a lot
he hardly ever plays, so he's not going to take a deal like that, is he?
That's true.
You got space on your team at the moment?
We're a bit too similar, really.
Right.
I can't have any more target men. some fun rumours. Ben Chilwell, Atletico Madrid, 71 million.
Won't happen.
James Maddison, Spurs.
Could happen.
Ashley Young, DC United.
Could happen.
Nonsense.
Why?
What? Well, no, the website from where that rumour came.
Oh, okay,
is
all right.
Oh, okay, fine.
Nonsense.
Neymar and Ousmane Dembele in a swap deal. Paolo Dybala to Bayern Munich.
Really, the Juventus stuff depends on the next manager. If Dybala, actually, I think, was more likely to leave if Allegri stayed as manager, because I think Allegri basically didn't have a spot for him this season. The next manager might come in and go, I really like this guy because he was brilliant a season ago, so why not?
Real Madrid have noticed that De Ligt is good, so they want him
really?
As well,
mm-hmm.
as Barcelona, Man United and everyone else.
I mean, the big
else.
One is Kylian Mbappe, of course.
What's going to happen to Mbappe?
He made, it was quite extraordinary when he was at the equivalent of the Footballer of the Year show in Paris, and he talked very openly about his ambitions, whether I'm in Paris or not, which on the night that he was voted the best player of Ligue 1 with Paris Saint-Germain. And there are loads of rumours.
The look on Thomas Tuchel's face when he said it was quite the picture.
So, yeah, it's interesting time, shall we say, at Paris Saint-Germain.
Are you saying Mbappe could go to Guingamp?
Yeah, something like that. Okay. It's all happening at PSG as well, with the Nasser Al-Khelaifi as well being investigated for active corruption in athletics. It's brilliant, isn't it? It's true.
No, I don't disbelieve you. I think for your own peace of mind, you know, it'd be nice. I reckon you should have a month off a year where you don't worry about people doing potentially dodgy things.
Okay.
They're just, you know.
It's a bit tough when you're a football journalist.
No, you're right.
You could go on a 4-month budgeting course.
That's the way to...
Just shut yourself off.
At least when you get in for, you know, class one, you can look to the bloke next to you and go, Spurs in the Champions League final, by the way.
That's all fun. You know, thanks a lot, guys.
Well, look, that'll do for today's pod. Thanks very much for coming. Thanks, Philippe.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention one more thing.
Oh, of course.
The fact that André Villas-Boas,
yeah,
who hasn't worked for 17 months, last job with Shanghai, where he didn't exactly pull trees or shrubs, and who spent his time mostly driving in, I think, like the Dakar rally and things like that, has been taken on as new Marseille manager, and the club has very little money, but they're going to pay him 5 million euros a year.
You mentioned people who fail upwards.
One of the biggest salaries in French football to André Villas-Boas.
Yeah,
he gets payoff after payoff. I mean, he's a genius, right?
Yeah.
I want a payoff.
It's not
like
quite
that.
In the Jose Mourinho league. I mean, no, okay. Jose is in the league of his own for
yeah,
that.
Yeah, but Jose's won some things.
Very true. Hmm. Well, André Villas-Boas was Russian champion.
I think he got a raw deal off Chelsea, to be fair.
Do you?
Hmm.
Okay.
He wasn't that bad at Spurs first season.
No.
No.
Still, amazing numbers of payoffs.
5 million.
Yeah.
A year.
Well, look, Philippe, thanks so much for coming.
Thank you.
Sorry that most of the things you said were edited out for legal reasons.
I'm used to it.
It's still nice to see you. Paolo, thanks very much.
Cheers.
Cheers, Baz.
You're welcome.
We'll be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.